Jeep did actually get in the vehicle with the suspect. As they were passing by her school, however, she started screaming because she saw that he was not, in fact, stopping.
Anchorage police investigate three attempted child abductions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 29th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers introduce legislation to make Juneau the governor's official home base.
Which would block the ability for the governor to be paid a traveling per diem if he's living in his own home somewhere out of Juneau.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
TransCanada and ExxonMobil today formally filed their request to take the Alaska Pipeline proposal to possible shippers to bid for space on the state-licensed project to take North Slope natural gas to market. Called the open season process, the application is under review by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and will be released to shippers in about 90 days. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The TransCanada and ExxonMobil partnership is proposing two options for shippers to consider and bid on: a 1,700-mile, 4.5 billion cubic foot per day line to Alberta, which would increase the supply of gas to the lower 48 and Canadian markets, or an 800-mile, 3 billion cubic foot line to Valdez, where it would be liquefied for shipment to North American or international markets. Either route would have an anticipated operating date in 2020. Paul Pike, Exxon's senior project manager, says the cost of getting the line into service has escalated since Alaska began its current push for getting North Slope gas to market, last estimated at $26 billion.
Current cost estimates for the project are in the range of $32 to $41 billion U.S. dollars, those are '09 dollars, for the North Slope to Alberta option, and in the range of $20 to $26 billion U.S. dollars for the Valdez option.
The lines are options, and TransCanada Vice President Tony Palmer says the developers will choose which route they'll take after they hear back from possible shippers during the open season. However, Palmer says the construction of both lines is not an option.
We've got a proposed volume of 4.5 BCF a day for the Alberta option, and 3 BCF a day, or billion cubic feet a day, for the Valdez option. Combined, that would be 7.5 billion cubic feet a day. I will tell you, we honestly do not believe there's that much initial gas to flow into this pipeline. So it's an either or. We don't think that there's sufficient gas to deliver 7.5 BCF a day on a sustained basis for the project.
Despite the higher construction costs, the FERC request reduces the tariff that would be paid by some shippers. Palmer and Pike say they're making offers to initial applicants that could save shippers $500 million a year for 25 years. They also say that an increased federal loan guarantee from $18 billion to $30 billion would substantially reduce tariffs by reducing financing costs. That proposal is currently pending in Congress. The Denali Pipeline, a partnering of ConocoPhillips and British Petroleum, will make its first application to federal regulators in April. And spokesman Dave McDowell says this first application will not have any bearing on their offer.
Denali is moving forward outside of the AGEA framework. We've got our own project proposal, and our team is real strong. You know, we've got a great team with some of the biggest world-class engineering firms on board. And we've been working hard to develop a cost estimate for this project. So, you know, I'm real confident that we're going to have an attractive commercial offering for our potential customers.
Exxon's Pike, in an opinion shared by McDowell, cautioned that there are issues that possible shippers will consider outside the control of the project: a foreseeable, stable state tax structure, and access to resources will be determined by interaction between the state of Alaska and producers. not the pipeline company. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Today, Anchorage police announced they are investigating three attempted child abductions occurring over the last 2 weeks. The latest one happened this morning. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
According to APD's public information officer, Marlene Lammers, all three incidents occurred on Anchorage's Greater East Side. The latest took place at about 7:45 this morning. An 11-year-old girl was walking to the bus stop from her home on the 5300 block of Taku Drive.
She was approached by a man in a vehicle who indicated that there was a moose ahead. He offered to give her a ride, which thankfully she declined. However, she then indicated that he accelerated and he struck her in the back, knocking her to the ground. He then got out of his vehicle, asked her if he could give her a ride to the hospital, which is where he stated that he worked. She refused and ran back home.
Lammers says this morning's incident was similar to one reported yesterday morning involving a 10-year-old girl walking to Ptarmigan Elementary School.
She was struck by either a vehicle or a person. She was uncertain which, but there was a young boy who had witnessed her getting hit. She, again, was knocked to the ground. The man got out, asked if he could give her a ride to her school, and she did actually get in the vehicle with the suspect. As they were passing by her school, however, thankfully, she started screaming because she saw that he was not, in fact, stopping. So when she began to scream, that's when he decided to stop the vehicle and let her out.
Lammers says these two recent abduction attempts closely resemble another incident occurring at 8:30 in the morning on January 14th and involving a 10-year-old girl walking to Creekside Elementary School.
She was struck by a vehicle and knocked down. Again, he offered to give her a ride, and she declined.
The public information officer says in all three cases, the suspect's description and his vehicle were similar.
They are all describing the suspect as a black male driving a dark-colored, smaller-style SUV, anywhere between 18 and 20 years old. I know that the victim yesterday indicated that the suspect may have had a mustache, but that doesn't mean he couldn't have shaved it off overnight. He was wearing a gray jacket or a gray hoodie and tan-colored pants.
Lammers says the girls are doing all right. She knows the first two were taken to the hospital to check for injuries. She was uncertain about this morning's intended victim. She offers this observation and important advice.
He is getting a little more brazen and bold, and we just want to encourage parents to talk to their children and remind them that don't ever get in the vehicle of somebody that you don't know. Don't talk to strangers, especially if you're alone.
The Anchorage police are asking that anyone with information about these attempted abductions to please call 786-8900. To remain anonymous but still be eligible for a cash reward, one can call Crime Stoppers at 561-STOP or send the tip to a secure website at www.anchoragecrimestoppers.com. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Two Southeast lawmakers want to make sure Juneau is the governor's home base. Sitka Senator Bert Stedman today introduced Senate Bill 244, which clarifies the capital city is the governor's duty station.
We don't have the authority through statutes to force the governor to live in Juneau, but this is as close as much as we can do to encourage him to, which would block the ability for the governor to be paid a traveling per diem if he's living in his own home somewhere out of Juneau.
Former Governor Sarah Palin rarely worked out of Juneau. Instead, she lived at her home in Wasilla, charging the state a per diem. She also billed the state when her kids traveled with her, sparking ethics complaints. Stedman says that kind of behavior influenced his decision to introduce the bill.
With the previous governor's light use of the mansion and little interest in residing in Juneau, it certainly encouraged this type of legislation.
Juneau Senator Dennis Egan, whose father was the state's first governor, signed on as a co-sponsor of the bill.
You know, we're the capital. Fairbanks is the center of education. and we have satellites. Anchorage is the center for commerce, and we're the center for government.
The bill was referred to the State Affairs and Judiciary Committees. Stedman is co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee. He's also working to include money for governor's mansion renovations in the state capital budget. Alaska's U.S. senators split their votes this week on raising the nation's debt limit. It passed the Senate yesterday, 62-39, on a party-line vote, with Democrats pushing it through. It increases the federal government's debt limit by $1.9 trillion, boosting it to more than $14 trillion, the highest level in history. Many Democrats said while they didn't want to raise the debt ceiling, they said it was a necessary step to prevent a government shutdown. Senator Mark Begich joined Democrats in voting for it, while Republicans, including Senator Lisa Murkowski, voted against it and said the nation must get a handle on its debt. Begich also supported a pay-as-you-go provision that passed along party lines. It would impose rules for the first time since 2002, mandating that Congress show where money will come from before spending it. Republicans did not support it. The debt limit bill now goes to the House. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Board of Game works on wide-ranging proposals.
We have mandates to provide for subsistence and for these religious purposes, as well as the resident hunting.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years.
The American Civil Liberties Union is honoring Tlingit leader Byron Malott as a defender of constitutional rights. The ACLU Alaska chapter named Malott winner of the Eric Johnson Champion of Native Rights Award. He was among five Alaskans recognized last weekend in Anchorage. Malott has served key roles in a variety of organizations and agencies. He was president of First Alaskans Foundation, a Native research and advocacy organization, and CEO of Sea Alaska, Southeast's regional Native corporation. He's also been mayor of Yakutat and Juneau and head of Alaska's Permanent Fund Corporation. And he continues as a Sea Alaska board member. He spoke about his vision on the future at the January 23rd awards ceremony.
One of the things that I use almost as a mantra when I think about the next 50 years of Alaska statehood is to close my eyes and think about a place in which every person is respected and has a sense of hope and opportunity, and where their abilities are cherished and advanced from birth through the oldest of age, where color and race and ethnicity are celebrated and respected, but not used as a way to separate us, but to bring us together in richness and strength.
Malott's award was named after an attorney who fought Alaska's English-only law. Bethel voters will head to the polls for another special vote on alcohol. The Bethel City Council recently set a date for the election, which could return the city to damp status. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
It will be the third time in less than 8 months that Bethel residents weigh in on alcohol sales. On May 4th, Bethel residents will have a chance to opt back into local option. If a majority vote yes, Bethel will return to damp, and the sale of alcohol will again be prohibited. The city council unanimously approved the election at their last meeting, but several did so begrudgingly, like council member Rick Robb.
I personally would have liked to see the opt-out work itself out for a while longer before we revote, but according to law, we don't have that choice. The fact that over 600 people signed the petition and 500 and some valid signatures, that is a lot of people for this town. That is a lot of voters.
If voters pass the ballot, it would reverse the outcome of the October election when 54% of Bethel voters revoked local option, throwing out more than three decades of sales prohibition. Immediately after that vote, community members began organizing this ballot petition. Under state law, a community can vote to become more restrictive of alcohol at almost any time. But to become less restrictive, a vote must wait 2 years. That means if the ballot is approved, local option opponents will be required to wait until 2012 for another election. Vice Mayor Eric Middlebrook says that is unfair.
There's something very basically undemocratic about this process in that if you happen to be on one side of this issue, you are allowed more access to this democratic process than if you happen to be sitting on the other side of this process. I think it's an unfair and unjust law.
Many are hopeful that even without the protection of local option, the community can prevent the sale of alcohol. A recent advisory vote shows overwhelming opposition to alcohol sales. The council has already protested four liquor license applications, but the ultimate say rests with the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. That board will review some of those applications at their February meeting. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The former Kuskokwim 300 race manager charged with stealing from the organization has changed her plea to guilty. Stacy Gilliland, of age 38, of Bethel, was the top administrator of the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race starting in 2007. But in 2008, she was charged with stealing from the nonprofit. Up to 25 counts were eventually leveled against her, including theft, forgery, and scheming to defraud. Up until now, Gilliland has maintained her innocence. But today, in court, she changed her plea to guilty. Gilliland has accepted a deal with state prosecutors. She will plead guilty to one count of theft in the second degree, a Class C felony. She has also agreed to pay restitution. In exchange, the other charges will be dropped, and Gilliland will not serve jail time.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN, covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
The state's Board of Game knuckled down today in Anchorage to deal with proposals affecting statewide wildlife management regulations. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The Alaska Board of Game will make decisions this weekend that may have implications for a wide range of activities, from Native Alaskan religious ceremonies to what kind of exotic pets Alaskans can have. Dale Rabe is deputy director of the state's Division of Wildlife Conservation.
But we've got other issues related to ceremonial harvest of wildlife as a customary and traditional activity. So it's a variety of things that we'll be looking at.
Board members and Alaska Fish and Game staff met in Anchorage's Egan Center to hear staff reports this morning. After the reports, the panel will hear public testimony on all proposals before the panel begins deliberations. Rabe says some proposals during the board session deal with the inclusion of hybrid cats and certain types of monkeys on the state's allowable exotic pet list. Most proposals, however, are put forward by people who hunt.
Most of them are related to intensive management or predator management programs in areas where caribou herds have been declining to try and stabilize or increase those populations. In addition to that, we're looking at the users and what are the priority uses for the animals that are available to the public, including ceremonial use as well as, you know, regular hunting use or subsistence hunting use.
Rabe says in times of a decline in resource abundance, users are more keenly aware of priorities.
And we have a complex system of uses and priorities here compared to a lot of other states that deal simply with recreational hunting because, you know, we have mandates to provide for subsistence and for these religious purposes, as well as the resident hunting. And in fact, a significant part of the revenue relative to wildlife management comes from non-residents. So we have to find balance between all of those different users, which becomes more difficult when animals are scarce.
Finding that balance among all user groups can be a challenge. Rabe says some proposals put forward this time could affect the structure and meeting frequency of the board. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Southeast commercial halibut fishermen will not see as big a cut to their catch limits as originally proposed. The International Pacific Halibut Commission today voted to go with somewhat higher numbers than its staff had recommended for this year. From KFSK in Petersburg, Matt Lichtenstein reports.
At the last day of its annual meeting in Seattle, the IPHC approved a 4.4 million pound quota for commercial longliners in Southeast Alaska. That's 12% less than last year's limit, but it will allow a bigger catch than commission staff had proposed. IPHC scientists were recommending a 26% cut in the limit for Southeast, where they say the stocks have been declining. Longliners have already seen more than 50% of their limit cut over the past 4 years in Southeast, which is known as Regulatory Area 2C. The rest of Area 2, including British Columbia and the Pacific Northwest, will also see a cut from last year, but again, not as much as recommended by staff. The commission approved limits of just over 800,000 pounds for the Northwest and 7.5 million pounds for BC. Commission alternate Susan Farlinger of the Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada explains some of the commission's rationale for the decision on the Southeast, BC, and Pacific Northwest limits.
The catch recommendations in their entirety reflect the Commission focus on conservation, but also on the impacts of bycatch and migration on all the regulatory areas. In the case of the three regulatory areas within Area 2, in which the Commission catch exceeds the staff recommendation, the Commission is recognizing the emerging but incomplete information on the impact of bycatch in these areas.
Farlinger also noted there was ongoing stock assessment work aimed at examining the impact of bycatch, the unintentional catch, of halibut and other fisheries. The commission's numbers for Area 2 were based on those proposed by its Fish Processors Advisory Group, but the decision to go with those smaller cuts than staff recommended was not unanimous. U.S. Commissioner Ralph Hoard was the lone dissenting vote. He thought the combined limit for Area 2 was too high. For the rest of Alaska, the commissioners unanimously approved the original staff recommendations. That includes an 8% drop in the limits for Gulf of Alaska Area 3A and a 9% drop in Areas 3B and 4A. In the Aleutians, there's a 16% increase recommended for Area 4B, while the allowable catch in Bering Sea Areas 4C, D, and E would increase by about 3%. The decision will put the total coastwide halibut limit at about 50,670,000 pounds. That's a decrease of about 6.3% from last year. Staff had been recommending a 10% decrease total. Speaking by phone after the annual meeting, Commission Director Bruce Lehman sounded an optimistic note about the future of the stocks.
We are starting to see some signs of improvement in the western area. You know, we believe it's still coming for the eastern areas of the stock. We need to get the harvest rate, we need to get that reduced somewhat from what we've been seeing in the past, but we do still see over the midterm some positive signs.
The commission also set the commercial halibut season dates for this year. It'll be open from March 6th through November 15th. The commission's catch recommendations still need approval from the federal governments in Canada and the U.S. before they're considered final. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The U.S. Coast Guard gave its Meritorious Public Service Award to the Sitka Mountain Rescue Team during a ceremony Wednesday at Air Station Sitka. The Mountain Rescue Team received the award after a perilous rescue in October. KCAW's Ed Ronco has details.
On October 15th, the U.S. Coast Guard dropped Sitka Mountain Rescue volunteers off on a steep slope up above Cold Storage Lake. Hunter Kyle Ferguson had fallen 200 feet and was injured. To make matters more complicated, once Sitka Mountain Rescue Captain Don Kluding reached Ferguson, the pair slid down a cliff face, stopping just shy of an 800-foot drop-off. Here's Coast Guard Rear Admiral Christopher Colvin speaking at Wednesday's award ceremony.
So you're on a mountain, you get inserted by a helicopter, the hunter has fallen 200 feet, all kinds of injuries, hypothermia, and Don, I think you got to spend a couple hours there hanging on, 10 feet away from a cliff, 800 feet straight down. He had one good foothold, right? That was about it. Can you imagine that? 10 feet away from a cliff, 800 feet straight down.
According to the award citation, Kluding and Ferguson had to hold on for 2 hours before they could get out of there. Then, with the assistance of other Sitka Mountain Rescue volunteers, they had to make an 8-hour journey on foot before they could reach terrain suitable for a helicopter to land and pull them out. The award issued Wednesday, officially called the Meritorious Public Service Award, was given to Sitka Mountain Rescue as a whole. Numerous people from both Mountain Rescue and the Coast Guard played a direct role in the October 15th operation.
There's everyday tasks, there's everyday a lot of missions where we go and we insert the Mountain Rescue to look for people, to search for folks. This was not just for this one, but accumulation of many other things. This is probably an award that's past due.
That's Coast Guard Captain Dave Walker, who is the commanding officer at Air Station Sitka. He says the Coast Guard personnel risk their lives, but that it's their job to do so. Sitka Mountain Rescue is comprised of volunteers.
And the fact was we put our Mountain Rescue folks in a perilous situation where they could have easily had perished. I mean, our Don Kluding was on the edge of a cliff. He was 10 feet away from a cliff and had the rocks begin to slide or had, you know, there was nothing else to grab hold to without his skill and his expertise. You know, one mistake and they both would have gone to their deaths. So it's important to recognize the service that these folks do.
Kluding, the Mountain Rescue captain, says he and his team are honored by the award, but the praise, he says, goes both ways.
It's kind of twofold. The Coast Guard deserves a heck of a lot of credit. You know, I have huge amount of gratitude and respect for what they do. I mean, it's unbelievable being able to be deployed on a hillside in the middle of the night. It's dark, it's blowing 40, it's raining, and you know, be able to be set down safely on a hillside, you know, at the location of the work that we have to be done. So once we were down on the hillside, you know, going up accomplishing the mission was, you know, what we train for, it's what we do. You know, just another day at the office, basically, for us.
If it's another day at the office, it's kind of a risky workplace. But Kluding says,
you know, all of those risks are mitigated by the training that we put into it and, you know, all the hours that the volunteers expend on training to make that happen and make it safe.
Kluding says Sitka Mountain Rescue has been around since the 1960s and presently has about 50 active members. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.